The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with drama in real life. Trapped at the bottom of the sea. It was supposed to be a routine job for a team of men who repair underwater pipelines. This one's diver's air supply cord snapped while he was 300 feet down. And there's a picture of a gentleman, looks like he's probably in his late 30s, early 40s, wearing a life vest, has a big diving mask in his hand, shaved head, and he looks like he's standing on the bottom of the ocean. Leaving his fiancée to go to work was harder for Chris Lemons than for most people. He is a deep-sea diver, typically away from home for four-week stints several times a year. This time he had a job replacing oil pipes at the bottom of the North Sea, more than 120 miles off Aberdeen in northeast Scotland. As Lemons, 32, well, he's younger than I thought, got ready to leave that day in September 2012, he gave his fiancée, Morag Martin, the usual reassurance, "Don't worry, it's a carefully controlled environment." "I'll miss you," said Martin, 39, "but we'll keep in touch all the time." The couple had met 5 years early at a party. Lemons, a 6'4" Englishman, was a diver and dive boat crewman. He was drawn to Martin's gregariousness, while she found him kind and funny. They started dating, and soon Lemons moved in with Martin. They lived frugally while he trained in 2011 in specialized saturation, SAT diving, a job that involves maintaining seabed pipes for the oil and gas industry. It has its risks, from decompression sickness to drowning. Several SAT divers have died in recent decades around the world, but Barton knew how much it meant to him, and it paid very well, helping the couple plan an exciting future together. Martin had recently become the head teacher at a school in the Scottish Highlands, and they were building a dream house overlooking the sea. Their wedding was set the following April. At home, their conversations ranged from what place setting shall we have at the reception to the complexity of house foundations. They also talked about having children and later moving to France, where Lemons had family. It was a joyful time. It's called saturating diving because of the intense pressures found in the deep sea. Gas that a diver breathes saturates the body. When the diver surfaces and the pressure drops, the gas can emerge as deadly bubbles in the blood and tissues, causing decompression sickness, or the bends. SAT divers reduce this risk by living full-time in a pressurized chamber on the dive ship. For the September job, Lemons would be part of a three-man team sharing the SAT chamber with three other teams for a month aboard the 340-foot vessel Topaz. He was delighted to learn he'd be working with Duncan Alcock. And there's a picture of Duncan Alcock and David Uwasa. Alcock, 50, had been diving in the North Sea for 17 years. He worked with Lemons, who had qualified 18 months early on his first few dives, becoming Lemons' unofficial mentor. In a competitive industry with only short-term contracts, Alcock strove to make Lemons look good in front of supervisors, giving him advice and nudging him away from mistakes. "If you're unsure about something, don't worry. I'll talk you through," he'd reassured Lemons. Their third team member would be David Uwasa, whom Lemons knew by his excellent reputation. For the first days in the chamber, the men chatted about Lemons' house build, his upcoming wedding, and Alcock's son, who just started working in diving. Lemons couldn't properly speak to Martin. Helium in the chamber made the divers' voices high-pitched and distorted, but they kept connected by email, and Martin sent pictures of her adventures cycling and climbing local mountains. Just before 9 p.m. on September 18th, it was Lemons' team's turn to dive. The three transferred to a diving bell, a smaller vessel for transport to the deep sea. The diving bell was loaded on cables around 250 feet below the Topaz. Lemons and Uwasa would descend further 50 feet to replace some pipe on a structure resting on the seabed. The men would be connected to the dive bell by umbilical cords attached to their diving suits. These two-inch-thick clusters of tubes carried air, communication lines, power for the lamps and cameras on their helmets, and hot water to keep their suit warms. The seawater was just 39 degrees Fahrenheit. At the core was a steel-reinforced rope. Each diver had 165 feet of this lifetime coiled and ready inside the bell. Alcock's job was to feed the line to the divers as needed. Above water, the wind was 35 miles per hour and the sea some 13 feet high. Rough, but nothing the Topaz couldn't handle. Instead of fixed propellers, the ship had five thrusters that could each be rotated. A dynamic positioning system kept the ship locked in place by constantly adjusting these, so there was no need for an anchor. The job was routine. Alcock told Lemons as he secured the heavy helmet for his partner. There's no rush. Take your time. Lemons gave him a thumbs up. He felt relaxed, focused, and ready to go. Dropping through the 2.5-foot hole at the bottom of the bell and into a dark ocean was always a magical moment for Lemons. Leaving behind the claustrophobic diving bell, he felt weightless, sediment and fleeting marine life caught in the light of his helmet lamp. He and Uasa started working with the manifold, a structure 30 feet high and 66 feet long. Its pipes and valves managed oil flowing from the wells to the platforms. Toiling a few feet apart with spanners and other tools, the pair would be underwater for 6 hours. Up on the ship, dive supervisor Craig Frederick sat before a bank of controls and monitors, showing the feeds from the divers' helmet cameras. He followed their progress, giving instructions by intercom for each stage of the job. Meanwhile, in the cramped bell, Alcock sat surrounded by gauges. He monitored his colleagues' oxygen and carbon dioxide levels, but had no communication with them. Lemons had been working for about an hour when he heard a noise from Frederick's control room, an alarm. Perhaps the crew was running a test? In fact, the Topaz had a major problem. The green light on Frederick's instrument panel was suddenly glowing amber, then red. I'd never seen that before, Frederick thought, alarmed. The positioning system had failed. The boat was now drifting and would soon drag divers with it. Leave your tools and get back to the bell, Frederick ordered. It was a highly unusual request, and Lemons and Uasa started climbing hand over hand up their umbilicals toward the top of the structure. In the bell, Alcock didn't know what was happening, but following Frederick's instruction to start hauling in the cords. Glancing up, Lemons had expected to see the bell's lights, but there was only blackness. Then he felt his umbilical tugging as he reached the top of the manifold and saw that it had looped around a metal outcrop. He struggled to unhitch it, but the knot only pulled tighter. What's going on? He thought. In the bell, Alcock saw Lemons' line suddenly go taut. Frederick ordered, "Give Tiber Dew more slack." "I can't," Alcock replied. Not only was it too tight, the cord was pulling its anchor off the wall. Steel struts bending, bolts groaning. It was unthinkable. If the cord broke off, it would leave Lemons adrift without oxygen. Alcock also knew that in his tiny space, if it came loose, it would knock him through the bottom of the bell into the water. He quickly climbed into his seat to get out of the way, but there was nothing he could do for Lemons. As Lemons struggled to free himself, Uasa tried to get back to help. Flailing his arms against the water, he almost made it. The two divers' hands were just a couple of yards apart when Uasa's cord yanked him away. Lemons saw a look of apology on Uasa's face as he disappeared into the dark. Lemons redoubled his frantic attempts to discharge the cord. He heard it creak ominously, and then the air supply line broke, followed by the communications feed. Unable to inhale, Lemons instinctively opened the emergency air tank on his back, as he'd done many times in training. Seconds later, there was a noise like a shotgun as the table snapped. His lifeline had severed completely. Lemons was thrown backward, sinking slowly, his helmet silent without the intercom, his lights dead, his suit beginning to cool. He knew he had about 8 minutes of oxygen. In the bell, Alcock feverishly pulled up the slack umbilical cord, hoping Lemons would be at the end of it. His heart sank as the broken hot water hose came up. Then came the hissing hairline. He felt sick. "I've lost my diver," he shouted to Frederick. Landing on the soft seabed, Lemons struggled to his feet in total darkness. The ship could crack him via a beacon on his suit, but he knew that if he could somehow get himself to the top of the manifold, there was a better chance of rescue before his oxygen ran out. Yet he had no idea where it was. What if he walked the wrong way into the blackness? He picked a direction at almost random and took cautious steps, feeling only the mud beneath his feet. Suddenly his outstretched hand struck metal. He gasped in relief and then began struggling up the structure, breathing hard. Reaching the top, he still couldn't see the bell. Not a speck of light. Where had the Topaz gone? He crawled onto the platform and clung to the metal grill, terrified the current would drag him away. He reckoned he had about 5 minutes of air left. He knew his chances of surviving this were slim. Yet the situation was even worse than he realized. The ship was now 700 feet away. The crew was desperately trying to steer back, but without the positioning system, it took two people to manually coordinate the thrusters. The Topaz was slowly zigzagging against the waves. The minutes passed, and Lemons' fear turned to grief. This is probably where I die. He'd never see their house finished, never have children. I'm sorry, Morag, he called out. His mind fumbled with mundane practicalities. Does she know where the next payment for the building work is due? He shouted out for Alcock. Where are you? His chest drew tighter as his oxygen dwindled. I hope dying doesn't hurt, he thought. He felt himself slowly slipping into unconsciousness. Frederick had ordered the Topaz's remotely operated underwater vehicle to go down and look for Lemons. It sent back pictures of him lying on the metal grill. His hands seemed to be twitching. Was he still alive, or were his limbs just moving in the current? It was 16 minutes since the umbilical had snapped. By now, Yuasa had made it back to the bell, poised to retrieve Lemons if they could get back into position. Frederick kept him and Alcock updated on the boat's progress, although he massaged the troop to keep their spirits up. We're nearly there. You also assumed he'd be recovering a body. Alcock's thoughts were darkening, too, and he wondered how to tell Martin that her fiancé wasn't coming home. The wait was agonizing, but he tried to keep hope alive. We've not forgotten you, lad, he said silently. Hang in there. Attempts by the Topaz's engineer to re-engage the positioning system had been futile, so in desperation they shut it down and restarted it. Amazingly, this worked. For more than 25 minutes had passed since Lemons' umbilical cord snapped. Finally, with the ship over the dive site, Yuasa dropped down and found Lemons on his back. He glanced through Lemons' mask. Ominously, there was water inside. He clipped Lemons onto a rescue lanyard and began hauling them both up the umbilical cord. Lemons was a big man. It was like trying to carry a giant starfish. By the time he was able to push Lemons' upper body into the bell, another 6 minutes had passed. Alcock unclipped Lemons' helmet, his eyes were closed, and his bald head blue as a pair of jeans. Alcock knew there was little chance of surviving that long without oxygen, but nothing to lose, he kept talking. You've had an accident. I'm going to give you CPR. He gave Lemons two breaths, and unbelievably, Lemons suddenly inhaled. His eyes opened, and he blinked. Alcock could have danced a jig. He's back with us. For Frederick watching via monitor, it was a big moment. Are you all right, he asked on the intercom. Lemons gave a weak thumbs up. Alcock probed him with questions after flushing his suit with Hawther. Do you know where you are? Yeah. You know you've had a broken umbilical? Yeah. Lemons was groggy, but remarkably seemed himself. Back in the ship's SAT chamber, he got medical attention while Yuasa and Alcock had, as Alcock remembers, a bit of a hug. Once Lemons was stable, they visited him. There were more hugs. Over the next 3 days, as the men depressurized on the Topaz, now docked at Aberdeen, they talked through what had happened over and over. It helped them deal with the shock. All gently teased Lemons about the CPR, saying that snogging or making out isn't usually done on a dive. How Lemons survived and without brain damage remains unclear. The oxygen in diver's gas is about 4 times richer than normal air, so his body may have been saturated with enough to keep him going. Hypothermia could have put him in shutdown mode, too, sending oxygen to his organs. When Lemons phoned Martin, she was horrified to hear about her fiancé's near-miss and raced across Sotna to beach him as he disembarked from the Topaz. They kissed and hugged for a long time. For a distraction, they went to the movies, but Martin barely saw the film through her tears. 3 weeks later, once Lemons was declared fit, he returned to the North Sea with Yuasa and Alcock to finish the job. I didn't want to lose my nerve, said Lemons, who was still an SAT diver. I'm proud of him, adds Alcock. Many would have said, this is too dangerous, I'm not coming back. The following April, Lemons and Martin got married in an emotional ceremony near their home. You also couldn't be there, but says Lemons, at the reception, people were buying Alcock whiskeys all night, and they were telling me, I don't even want to speak to you, I just want to hug you. The band played until 4 a.m., and the place was jumping, recalls Martin. People knew it was the wedding that almost never was. Lemons and Martin have since adopted a little girl, Euba. That's interesting, E-U-B-H. They finished their house, but their life plans have accelerated. We're selling the house and moving to France already, says Martin, smiling. I've had a glimpse of dying, and I'm not scared, says Lemons. I know I'm lucky to have a second chance. I've always had a lust for life, and the accident only made that stronger. How about some brain games? Determine either each fact statement is fact or fiction. To reveal the solution to the bonus questions at the bottom, write the letter indicated in each next year's responses. Actually, we're not going to do that, but we'll give you a chance. First question is, at the time the Constitution was ratified, Philadelphia was the nation's capital. Is that fact or fiction? It's fiction. New York was the capital at that time. Toni Morrison regretted picking that as her pen name. That was fact. In fact, she said, wasn't that stupid? She was born Chloe Warford and once said, it sounds like some teenager. Number 3, a cloud can weigh more than 1,000,000 pounds. That's a fact. Half of all the potatoes grown in the United States become McDonald's French fries. Fact or fiction? Fiction. About 7% of them do, in fact. Albert Einstein was offered the position of President of Israel. Is that a fact or fiction? It's actually a fact in 1952, but he turned it down. And this is an interesting one. The Greenland shark can live for 400 years. Is that fact or fiction? Of course, you would think it was fiction, but actually it's fact. The phonetic alphabet, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, etc., has three dances, fought, trot, tango, and waltz. Is that fact or fiction? That's fiction. W actually is whiskey, which I assume would mean that if you drank enough, you could do either the fox or the foxtrot or the tango. Number 8, the first Ferris wheel could hold more than 2,000 riders at a time. That's actually fact. President Andrew Jackson had a pet parrot. Fact or fiction? That's a fact. In fact, he embarrassed the whole place when at his funeral the parrot started to cuss. Bonus question. What is on the bottom of Mississippi's signature dessert and on top of Massachusetts? Chocolate. Reader's Digest read-up. These are things that I get since we ran out of items in the regular Reader's Digest because of this, a short month. And these are things I get every day from Reader's Digest. They're actually from Reader's Digest at some point. Things that are usually cheaper in the morning. Being a morning person can help you save money. Here's what you get for less if you shop early. Gas. Saving money on gasoline might just be worth getting up at the crack of dawn. The best time to buy gas is right before dawn or very late at night. Gas stations are known to raise their prices around rush hour, so avoid filling up your tank at those times. Movie tickets. Movie tickets prices vary greatly depending on location and theater chain. However, it's possible to see movies for less if your theater offers a pre-matinee. Megan Brophy, a retail and shopping analyst at Fit Small Business, says these cheap tickets are typically available on weekdays. Cinemark and Hawkins Theater both offer early tickets with a discount. Financial industry analyst Jacob Lindisky adds that it's worth checking in with your local theaters, too, since they often run special deals and early bird promotions. Flights. The cheapest days of the week to fly are Tuesdays and Wednesdays, according to Cheap Air Study. To get the most for your money, however, purchase tickets before noon. Dustin Ferguson, the founder of personal finance website Dime Will Tell, says it's worth getting up early to score more affordable airfare. It's popular wisdom in the travel hacking community that you can get a slightly better deal on your flight if you book before noon, he says. Well, this isn't always true, and there are certainly instances where this won't work. It seems to be the case more often than not, and you can save by booking early in the morning rather than later in the day. U.S. News & World Report found that the cheapest flights are the ones that leave early in the morning, too. Electricity. According to the Environmental Defense Fund, using energy during off-peak hours, including in the morning, could save you money on your bill. Specific peak and off-peak hours do vary, but a general rule of thumb is that electricity peaks during the late afternoon and in comparison to the early morning for save on energy. So run your dishwashers and laundry in the morning for the cheapest rates, Brophy says. Ride shares. Although surge pricing happens whenever and whenever rides are in demand, the priciest time to consistently occur during rush hour. There's a way to circumvent these prices if you have a flexible schedule, according to Brophy. While ride-hailing apps can be more expensive during morning commute hours, off-peak hours typically begin around 11 a.m., she says. So if you're flexible in your timing, wait until late morning to call an Uber to avoid surge pricing. And test preps and tutors. Kenneth Boyd, a certified CPA and a writer at AIS CPA, says any test prep takers could score a deal with early morning sessions before noon. Tutors tend to offer lower prices in order to decongest their schedule for evening hours when the demand is higher, with everyone looking to grab a lesson after work or school, Boyd says. Even if it's not included in the offer, you can negotiate directly with a tutor if they have the time to make their meetings before noon. And ticketed events. Museums and art galleries offer early bird specials and discounted admission during off hours. Even on weekends, the most popular time to visit museums is in the afternoon. So visit in the morning for a chance at discounted admission, Brophy says. The Metropolitan Opera has $25 rush tickets available for purchase on a first-come, first basis throughout their website in the morning. Haircuts. The best time of the day to book hair appointments during the week is just before noon, Britt & Company reports, that prices spike around 3 p.m. According to research from NetCredit, morning hair appointments are the best time of day for another reason, attitude. Hairdressers are less stressed in the morning, which could make them more enthusiastic and attentive. 10 surprising things that can hurt your property values. Your home is one of your biggest purchases, so it makes sense that you want to protect your investment. Read on to learn about 10 surprising things that decrease a home property's value. Bad neighbors. Having a neighbor with a junk-strewn yard, loud dogs, or a penchant for wild parties? If so, that it erodes your property value in addition to theirs. Another issue is living by a registered sex offender. Find out if there are any in your neighborhood by searching the National Sex Offender Public website. Poor exterior paint quality. Your home's exterior is the first impression people get of your house. So exterior paint that's faded, cracked, or peeling is a big turnoff. Another negative is painting your home an offbeat color. Buyers favor neutral colors like gray, white, cream, and beige. So pick your colors with care and repaint the exterior when it starts to look bad. Deferred maintenance. Have a backlog of serious repairs such as leaky roof, damaged siding, or a sputtering HVAC system? If so, it's best to tackle them ASAP. Letting them languish on your to-do list will only chip away at your home's property value. What's more, it's often more expensive to remedy these issues the longer you wait. Neighborhood foreclosures. A foreclosure close to your home hurts your home's property value. That's because appraisers look at comparable selling prices in your neighborhood when estimating your home's value. What's more, foreclosed homes may sit vacant without any maintenance for a long time, and that doesn't bode well for your property value. Proximity to certain facilities and businesses, there's not much you can do about this. Study shows that living close to certain businesses and facilities can drag down property values. Being in close to proximity to the following are associated with these drops in property value. Bad school, 22%. Strip club, 15%. Homeless shelter, 13%. Cemetery, 12%. That's too bad. They're very quiet neighbors. Funeral home, 6.5%. Same difference. Power plant, 5%. Shooting range, 3.7%. Of course, that only happens usually during the day. And a hospital, 3.7%. An unsightly yard. They call it curb appeal for a reason. If your yard is in poor condition or overrun with stuff, expect your property value to suffer. On the flip side, elaborate landscaping or a koi pond can also put a dent in your property value, since many homeowners don't want to handle the extra maintenance. A final yard-related turnoff, trees located too close, less than 20 feet to your house. The address suffix. It may sound crazy, but your address suffix could increase your property value up to 36%. Research shows that boulevard, place, and road addresses are the most expensive. Suffixes associated with lower property values in street, drive, and avenue. That's interesting. Too much personalization. When a buyer tours a house, they quickly take note of all the projects they'll need to do. Topping their list are things like removing quirky wallpaper, painting over unusual colors, and replacing unconventional fixtures. One time when I was looking at a house, they had a black bedroom for their teenage boy. Believe me, we did not go for that house. Painting over unusual colors and replacing conventional fixtures. If you're going to something offbeat, try to ensure it can be easily removed or immersed when it's time to sell. A garage conversion. Converting your garage to a gym, playroom, home office, or anything else besides a place to park cars is a sure way to lower your property value. That's because the vast majority of buyers want a space for their cars and yard equipment. If you want to use your garage for any other purpose, do so in a way that makes it easy to convert back to a conventional garage. Lots of carpet. Carpet tends to show damage easily, can be difficult to clean, and retains odors. What's more, many buyers are turned off by certain colors. A better flooring option is hardwood or laminate. In fact, one study revealed that 54% of home buyers are willing to pay more for hardwood floors. 14 big facts that were left out of history. Sometimes the most interesting information gets lost on the cutting room floor. Rosa Parks was not the first woman to defy racist bus laws. In 1955, a young woman in Montgomery, Alabama, caused a stir when she refused to give her bus seat to a white passenger. She was the first person arrested for protesting Montgomery's racist busing rules, and her defiance eventually became the subject of international attention. That woman was named Claudette Colvin. Actually, she was just a girl, 15 years old. Of course, it is Rosa Parks who went down in history for defying the Jim Crow laws in the same way later that year. For the record, it's a popular misconception that both women were arrested for sitting in whites-only sections. Colvin knew Parks from the NAACP youth group, and she also knew that Parks was the better person to be a figurehead in their city's growing protest movements. Parks had done prior work with the NAACP, and the organization didn't want a teenager in the role, Colvin explains. After decades of obscurity, Colvin eventually received the praise she deserved for her unsung heroism in Montgomery. Although she may not hold as prominent a place as Parks in textbooks, she has no regrets over her protest. I feel very proud of what I did. Christopher Columbus thought the earth was shaped like a pear. Yes, Christopher Columbus believed the world was round, as did sailors and mathematicians going back to ancient Greece. However, he did not think the earth was a perfect sphere, and that it was likely because he was a very famous poet. According to the logbook of his third voyage to the Americas, Columbus suspected the world was in the form of a pear, and its highest peak had the biblical Garden of Eden on its summit. This is precisely how the earth was described by Dante Alighieri in his epic poem, The Divine Comedy, the most influential work of Italian literature and history. Dante placed the Garden of Eden atop an impossibly high mountain surrounded by an ocean, which Columbus incorrectly determined to be the present-day Venezuela. A girl's fake testimony helped push the United States into the Gulf War. In 1990, a representative of the Kuwaiti-sponsored Citizens for a Free Kuwait hired New York public relations firm Hill & Knowlton to help persuade the American government to join in a war against Iraq. After a few months and $12 million in research money, the group found a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl named Naraya to deliver horrifying testimony to the Congressional Human Rights Caucus about hospitals being looted and premature babies being left to die. Amnesty International corroborated Naraya's testimony, which quickly became a talking point for U.S. Senators and President George H.W. Bush during the build-up to the Gulf War. In 1992, after the Americans had crushed the Iraqis in a mere 42 days of combat, an op-ed in the New York Times revealed that Naraya was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. Her entire testimony was dismissed and false, and Hill and Knowlton's role in the PR move was made public. Alexander Graham Bell did not actually invent the telephone. In 1860, a Florentine emigrant in New York named Antonio Meucci demonstrated a remarkable invention he called the Teltrofono. Sadly, Meucci could not find a sponsor for his product, and after several mishaps, he could not afford the fee for even a temporary patent. Enter Alexander Graham Bell, who just so happened to share a laboratory with Meucci. Bell didn't get a patent for his telephone until 1876, 16 years after Meucci had unveiled his prototype. Bell soon struck a deal with Western Union to sell his device. Meucci sued Bell for fraud, and the case was nearing the Supreme Court when Meucci died in 1889. It took until 2002 for the Italian inventor to be vindicated. That was when the U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution declaring that his work in the invention of the telephone should be acknowledged. Charles Lindbergh was not the first to fly across the Atlantic. This is pretty well known. Lindbergh became an international hero when he flew nonstop from Long Island to Paris in 1927. It was the first time anyone had attempted such a feat, if you overlook John Alcock and Walter Arthur Whitton Brown, two British pilots who flew from Newfoundland to Ireland in 1919. So while Lindbergh deserved credit for completing the first world solo trip, Alcock and Brown were the first to fly across the ocean, along the way surviving what sounds like an action movie, rain, snowstorm, fog, and ice. At one point, they nearly spiraled into the sea. "We had a terrible journey," Alcock says. After more than 16 hours battling the elements, the pilots landed in a bog at Ireland. A few days later, King George V knighted them. Landing a man on the moon wasn't all that popular. The moon landing may be fondly remembered as one of the greatest achievements in human history, particularly by those who witnessed it on live television. However, opinion polls taken in the 1960s and 70s found that everyday Americans were far from universally enamored of the space race. Shortly after the Apollo 11 mission was completed in July 1969, only 53% of Americans believed that the moon landing was worth the tax dollars invested. According to Forbes, the Apollo program cost about $25 billion, or about $150 billion adjusted for inflation. 10 years later, another poll found that only 41% of Americans felt the benefits of the space program ultimately outweighed its cost. Many future celebrities fought in World War II. Bea Arthur joined the U.S. Marine Corps Women's Reserve in 1943 before heading to Broadway in Maud. Future New York Yankee Yogi Berra saw action at Omaha and Utah beaches on D-Day. Comedian Mel Brooks fought in the Battle of the Bulge. Jimmy Stewart was promoted from private to colonel and eventually became a brigadier general in the U.S. Air Force. Clark Gable flew 5 combat missions in a B-17. Suave actor David Niven was already well known when he took a break from acting to become a commando in the British Army. Peter Sellers was in the Royal Air Force before graduating to the Pink Panther. Aubrey Hepburn was a teenage volunteer in the Dutch Resistance. Lee Marvin served as a Marine and was wounded in the Battle of Saipan. Tony Curtis witnessed Japan's surrender on September 2, 1945. And Julia Child had a top-secret post in the Office of Strategic Services. She even assisted researchers in trying to develop a shark repellent that would keep sailors from becoming underwater male. There was also a famous baseball player who was a spy as well. The 4th of July should be on July 2nd or August 2nd. On July 3rd, 1776, John Adams sent his wife exciting news. The Second Continental Congress had approved a resolution for American independence. It was such a historic moment that Adams wrote, "The second day of July, 1776, will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival, complete with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from the one end of the continent to the other." The adoption of what we call the Lee Resolution on July 2, 1776, marked the moment the 13 colonies were effectively independent from Great Britain. After a short wait while the Declaration of Independence was written on parchment by Timothy Matlack, a Pennsylvania clerk renowned for his good handwriting, John Hancock and his colleagues signed it on August 2, 1776, a full month after John Adams inaccurately predicted July 7th would be celebrated as the 4th of July is today. So what's got July 4th to recommend it? It was actually the day that the Continental Congress finally agreed on and approved the famous language in the Declaration. In other words, the 4th of July is really a celebration of unity. The War of the Worlds panic was more like a skirmish. On October 31, 1938, the New York Times ran a front-page story headlined, "Radio Listeners in Panic. Many flee homes to escape gas raid from Mars." The culprit, 23-year-old Orson Welles, who several hours earlier had read a radio adaptation of H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds with his fellow actors. Was there panic in the streets? No. According to a national survey conducted the evening of the broadcast, only 2% of the participants had listened to Welles' War of the Worlds production. The other 98% likely had no idea what he was up to and learned about it later. While some of that 2% might have thought the country had been invaded, there were probably a few in number and more afraid of a war with Germany than with the Martians. However, the idea of a science fiction broadcast causing panic was a trick too delicious for newspapers to resist at Halloween. Some women suffrage leaders wanted only white women to vote. I remember reading about this earlier. This year marks the 100th anniversary of women winning the right to vote. But the victory wasn't as sweet as we'd like to think. Some of those at the forefront of the suffrage movement, fearful that the questions of race would make their battle more difficult, wanted to advocate for white women alone. Elizabeth Cody Stanton, arguably the leading voice for women's rights along with Susan B. Anthony, occasionally delved into what biographer Laura Ginsburg addressed as ugly, racist rhetoric that prioritized educated, virtuous white women over black men and women. Sojourner Truth, the former slave who was also a leading voice for women's rights, ultimately broke with Stanton over a refusal to agree that women of every color deserved the right to vote. Even after the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920, poll taxes and other obstacles barred African-American women and men from voting throughout the South. It was not until the passage of the 24th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that millions of African-Americans were finally able to exercise their voting rights previously denied to them. The Founding Fathers embraced Islam. George Washington invited Muslims to work at his home. John Adams praised Muhammad as one of the history's greatest inquirers after truth, alongside Socrates and Confucius. Thomas Jefferson taught himself Arabic using a Quran and even hosted an iftar dinner at the White House during Ramadan. Why were there such openness to Islam in the early states? One reason. Morocco's Sultan Muhammad III was the first head of state to formally recognize the 13 colonies' independence from Great Britain in December 1777. Following the Revolutionary War, Jefferson, Adams, and the Sultan signed the U.S.-Morocco Treaty of Peace and Friendship in 1786. After more than 230 years of conflicts and crises, it remains the longest unbroken treaty in U.S. history. Now that's interesting. Joe McCarthy almost chickened out on giving the speech that made him famous. The 1950 Lincoln Day Dinner in Wheeling, West Virginia, was where little-known Senator Joseph McCarthy lobbed one of the most meteoric political bombshells of the 20th century. Apologize for that. "I have here in my hand a list of 205, McCarthy told the assembly and rubber's power brokers, "a list of names that were made known to the Secretary of State as being members of the Communist Party and who nevertheless are still working and shaping policy in the State Department." It was a brazen lie, delivered by McCarthy with supreme confidence that would turn his name into an ism and crush the careers of hundreds of Americans. Yet as Larry Tye writes in his new book, Demagogue, McCarthy wasn't nearly as gutsy as appeared. The senator had a second speech in his pocket that day, a snoozer about national housing policy, which was his real pet cause. But the red-baiting barn burner seemed more likely to grab the limelight, so why not? And when it put him on the front pages of newspaper, there was no turning back. Abraham Lincoln was one macho guy. We remember Lincoln for being tall and gangly, cerebral and honest, but before he entered the White House, he was a real he-man. He was a skilled wrestler in his youth who would occasionally referee other fights, including cockfights. When he was challenged to a duel in 1842, Lincoln requested broadswords so he could intimidate his notably shorter opponent with his reach. His foe reached a truce after Egg sliced a tree branch above the man's head. Lincoln was fearless in political battle, too. When a fight broke out at a campaign event, he reportedly picked up one of the offenders by the neck at the seat of his trousers and threw him 12 feet away. Eleanor Roosevelt was a target of the FBI. We think of Roosevelt as a beloved first lady who helped lift the nation's spirits through the Great Depression and World War II, an ardent defender of human rights and a delegate to the United Nations. So why did the FBI spy on her for 40 years, compiling a file of more than 3,200 pages? Despite her reputation today as a transformative first lady, Roosevelt's power earned her all sorts of enemies, not the least the political opponents of FDR. J. Edgar Hoover, the almost omnipotent director of the FBI, was especially troubled by Mrs. Roosevelt's embrace of liberal causes and civil rights activists, many of whom he suspected were communists. The public didn't find out about the extraordinary record that the FBI kept on the First Lady until 1982. To this day, 12 pages of the file are still classified. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. The ABCs of RVs. Traveling by motorhome, a.k.a. RV, lets you hit the road with many of the conveniences of home. An increasing number of Americans are giving RVing a go. Rentals surged in the summer of 2020, and in 2021 so far, RV ownership is a record 11.2 million households, almost a third of which are first-time owners, according to IPSOS and GoRV. Before you rent or buy, every potential RVer should know a few basics. First off, there are three standard types of motorhomes, classes A, B, and C. The class designation describes the vehicle structure, referring to the chassis and the body construction of the RV. Size and price can vary widely within each class, but in general, you'll find the smallest RVs, which are not much bigger than a van, in Class B, a variety of medium class options in Class C, and the largest RVs, which can be as big as an interstate bus, in Class A. Look for a model with important safety features such as an automatic emergency braking and electronic stability control. RV shoppers should also insist on quality tires and fit them with tire pressure monitors to avoid underinflation and blowouts, risking an RV all over or an accident. And this Class A, 30 to 40 feet long, average cost $160,000 to $220,000 or more, sleeps 6 to 8 people, CRs take. These bus-shaped models accepted providing a lot of space for their size with abundant storage. Manufacturers offer a wide variety of layouts, from medium to large RVs, and prices. It's in the class that you'll find the biggest and most luxurious coaches, often referred called diesel pushers due to the engine being in the rear. Many also have slides, sections that extend out when the RV is parked to create a wider interior. Pros come in many sizes and finish levels. Furnishings can range from basic interiors to resemble a gilded yacht cabin. The largest models have strong rear-mounted diesel engines. The cons can be tricky to drive and park, may not fit smaller campsites. Some national parks have RV length limits, poor fuel economy, and not all seats may have full seat belts. Mainly they include shoulder and lap belts. Class B, 20 to 24 feet long, $95,000 to $135,000, sleeps 2 to 4 people. Based on a van, Class B RVs are typically the smallest in size, but often cost the most per square foot. That's because they tend to pack a lot of premium functions into a tiny amount of cabin space, including, for example, a kitchenette rather than a full kitchen, a sofa/bed, and a small bathroom with some with a shower over the toilet area. As a result, they can feel cramped, but their modest size makes it easier to drive and park. Best fuel economy of any class motorhome. Durable, full-metal body construction. Advanced safety equipment may be easier to find because it's offered on many models. That's a pro. Cons. Better for day tripping than overnight camping due to limited sleep space. Can be short on amenities because of space constraints. Pricey given their small size and limited interiors, and relatively few floor pan options. And then we get Class C, which are 22 to 33 feet long, $80,000 to $120,000, and that'll sleep 4 to 8 people. I imagine 8 people would be very cramped. Often the best value, Class C motorhomes combine a van cab front with an RV shell. These typically have an over-the-cab sleeping area, the rooftop bulge that sticks out front, offering a nozzle-mine of sleep pace, and yet they're still easier to drive than a large Class A RVs. There are also pricier, heavy-duty Super C models that are built on a medium-duty truck platform and offer more engine power than standard Class C motorhomes. The pros, commonly the least expensive choice. They have a decent amount of bed space without adding length to the RV. Bottles less than 25 feet long are easier to drive and park, and wide variety of flow pans options. The cons, the cab area may be cramped due to an engine cover that intrudes into the space on some fan-based models. Moderately priced cab engine combinations are limited. There are a few high-end options, but most Class C RVs stop short of the decadence found in Class A coaches. Smart speaker that swivels to follow you. The Amazon Echo Show 10 smart speaker at $250. Amazon's latest Alexa-powered smart speaker, the Echo Show 10, introduces a unique feature. By using motion-sensing technology to track your movements, the 10-inch screen pivots around its base so that it continues to face you even as you move around the room. This rotating screen may come in handy for multitaskers. If you're moving around your kitchen to prep a meal, it will rotate to follow you so that you continue to read the recipe directions or to video chat. In our lab tests, the Show 10 received high marks, placing it among the top 5 of all 45 smart speakers in our current ratings. Testers note that it's easy to use and has some convenient features, such as voice command to control many common streaming services and a dedicated button to mute its microphones when you don't want it to listen. Though its sound quality receives a good rating, it isn't quite up to its predecessor, the second-generation Echo Show, in that respect. Outside of our labs, CR's technology reporter tried out the Show 10's moving screen in a real home kitchen. Generally, it functioned as promised, he reported. It followed the user, whether nearby or across the room, but it sometimes stopped so that the camera was pointed at the user's shoulder instead of his face. He also discovered that it's important to keep the surrounding area clear so that the rotating screen doesn't collide with anything in its path. The Show 10's quiet electric motor is so strong that it knocked down a heavy travel mug and a plastic bottle of cooking oil that was mostly full. Amazon included a 15-inch diameter template, roughly the size of a beach ball, to measure the space that needs to be clear around the Show 10. So if you're interested in a smart speaker, be sure to carve out a sizable chunk of real estate on the countertop to keep it clear. Super Smoothie Makers. These four blenders aced our test for making icy drinks, are easy to operate and clean, and won't bust your budget. The test blenders in our labs, we rip up non-alcoholic pina colada. The result we look for is a thick, consistently smooth texture that doesn't have any chunks of fruit or ice. And the best one is the Instant Ace at $80. Got a 77 overall score. Comes with a food processor attachment is the Oster Classic Series with food processor. That's the BMT-02, $90. Got a 69 overall score. Small compact footprint for small kitchens is the Hamilton Peach Digital Smoothie Smart for $50. Got a 59. And the bargain price was the Faberware Performance MJBL450 at $35. Got a 51 overall score. CR Insights for your food IQ. Decoding milk labels. Grass-fed, ultra-pasteurized. You may have noticed a number of confusing phrases on your milk carton lately. Here we explain some now common labels you'll find on milk and what they really mean. Produced without small RBST. Some farmers give the growth hormone RBST or RBGH to cows to increase milk production, which the Food and Drug Administration says is safe for consumers. But some experts have concerns about cancer and other risks from consuming milk from these cows. Many dairy companies no longer give cows RBST, but you can look for this phrase in no synthetic hormones. Sorry about that. My tongue got twisted. Grass-fed. When cows eat only grass, it may improve the nutrients in their milk. Some research has found higher levels of heart-healthy omega-3 fatty acids and antioxidant carotenoids. Sell-by. Federal regulations don't require product dating on milk, or any product for that matter except the infant formula. But some milks show the date to indicate when they should be still of good quality. Sell-by tells the store how long to display the product for sale and doesn't protect the safety of the milk. Vitamins A and D added. Adding these vitamins is voluntary, but most milk producers include them. Vitamin A is typically put in reduced fat and skim milk because it's lost in the process of removing fats. Vitamin D, which isn't found in many foods, is added for consumers who may be deficient. Ultra-filtered. This is a mechanical filtering process that boosts the protein in milk and reduces and even eliminates ingredients some people want less of, such as lactose. For example, Fairlife ultra-filtered milk has 5 grams more protein and 70 milligrams more calcium than typical milk, and it's lactose-free. Ultra-pasteurized. Most milk sold in the U.S. is pasteurized, a process that subjects raw milk to high heat in order to kill bacteria that can cause illness and spoilage. Ultra-pasteurized milks are exposed to an even higher temperature to kill more bacteria and triple or quadruple its shelf life. But once you've opened the milk, it will last just 7 to 10 days. What's in your milk? An 8-ounce glass supplies about a quarter of an adult's daily calcium needs, more than half the vitamin B12 requirement, and 8 grams of protein. But fat and calorie content varies by the type of milk. The whole milk is 3.25% fat, 150 calories, and this is an 8-ounce bottle, has 8 grams of fat, and saturated fat of 4.5 grams. The reduced fat is 2% milk, is 120 calories, 5 grams of fat, and 2.5 grams of saturated fat. Low fat, which is 1%, is 110 calories, 2.5 grams of fat, 1.5 grams of saturated fat, and skim milk has 0% fat, only has 85 calories, no fat, and no saturated fat. Product update. The latest ratings from our labs. Air treatment use increased during COVID-19. Percentage of consumers who say they are using air treatment appliances more than since COVID-19, that's 46%. Is your indoor air fit to breathe? The best air purifiers from CR's test can help remove pet dander, dust, mold, allergens, smoke particles, and more. And there's a picture here of a very complicated filter. And one, it's the thing is, this airflow is created when the unit is turned on, triggering an internal fan to draw in air and pollutants. A fabric pre-filter catches larger particles like dust, hair, and dirt, and hair. Some metals have an activated carbon fever filter, which can trap light household odors. The dense web of the HEPA filter traps smaller pollutants like smoke and particles that contain viruses, and sanitized air flows back into the room. Those who suffer from allergies know sometimes eye-watering effects of exposure to pollen or pet dander, but breathing certain pollutants can be even more serious. Small particles of 10 microns diameter or less, like those found in dust and smoke, can make their way deep into the lungs, aggravating them and potentially causing asthma attacks and even heart attacks in people with heart disease. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, long-term exposure to high particle levels is due to bronchitis, reduced lung function, and premature death. And we are so lucky that we're not in those fire areas out in the West where it's really become bad. Add to these concerns the presence in 2020 of wildfires in places such as California and the Pacific Northwest, and the airborne COVID-19 virus, and you can understand why air purifiers, the best of which remove these particles, have surged in popularity. Though the pandemic reduced a pressing reason to improve indoor air, the sales of portable home purifiers has been upswing on for years. Research suggests that by 2028, the global air purifier market will have reached $22.8 billion, according to Grandview Research. The U.S. is expected to account for roughly $4.5 billion of that. In 2020 alone, U.S. demand for air treatment appliances grew by 57%, according to a marketing analyst report by Verify Markets. Experts believe that the popularity will continue. I think COVID-19 is just increasing the visibility of air purifiers, says Misha Kalanati, the senior project leader for air purifier testing at CR. It likely got more of us thinking, sure, COVID spreads through the air, but what else are we breathing? The best purifier for your needs. In our labs, we evaluate air purifier models on their highest and lower settings for removal of particles as small as 0.1 micron and up to 1 micron, a range that can include dust mite, allergens, cat allergens, smoke, smog, and dust. We don't measure for particles larger than 1 micron because any model that scores well in our test should be able to handle the larger airborne particles. We also test noise levels and calculate the annual cost of ownership. You see our test results in the ratings, and we'll look at those later. And read on more for more selecting the best model for your home. Choose the right filter type. The best air purifiers, and the bulk of what CR tests, have mechanical filtration systems. These use an internal fan to draw particle-rich air into the machine, forcing it through a complex net of fibers and a pleated filter. The most effective of these have a very fine mesh filter called a high-efficiency particulate air HEPA filter. HEPA filters are able to capture 99.97% of particles as small as 0.3 micron, which is a worst-case scenario, though they can capture particles larger and smaller than that. You may also see models that use other air purifying technologies, which CR experts believe may be less effective though we can speak only to models tested in our labs. Consider your space. It can get expensive to outfit every room with its own air purifier, so your best bet is to choose one or two models for the areas where you spend most time, like your bedroom, living room, or home office. Then match the model to your room size. To do this, check for the air purifier's clean air delivery rate, CADR number. The CADR number reflects in cubic feet per minute or per hour the volume of clean air that an air purifier produces at its highest speed setting. According to the Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers, AHAM, a general rule of thumb is to select an air purifier with a CAD number that is at least two-thirds of the room's area. So if a room that's 10 by 12 feet with an area of 120 square feet, you'd want an air purifier with a CADR of at least 80. Some models have labels with three different CADR numbers for dust, tobacco, smoke, and pollen, says Kolontai. That means the product has been tested to standards set by the AHAM and certified to have those output levels for different pollutants. When choosing a model to buy, focus on the CAD number for the pollutant you're most concerned about. For example, if you live with a smoker, look for a high tobacco smoke CADR. Factor in future cost. The air purifiers we tested range from price from $40 to more than $1,000. While the top model in our ratings, the Blue Air Classic 605, is a price of $830, we found a Fandival of very good performers that cost less than $300, including the Honeywell Insight HPA 5300, Honeywell HPA 300, and Germ Guardian AC 5900. But keep in mind that most air purifiers have a removable filter that you need to replace every 3 to 6 months at a cost of $40 to $200 per year. And because these appliances are designed 24/7, you want to factor in energy costs. Look for purifiers with an Energy Star rating, which indicates that they use up to 40% less energy than regular models. The annual cost column on our ratings factors in both filter replacements and energy cost. Look for quieter operation. Generally speaking, higher fan speeds will increase the amount of air filtered, a good thing. But don't expect that clean air to come quietly. CR evaluates that noise levels of each model we test. Though some units are quieter than others, you will hear any of them running. That's particularly important to note if you'll be putting one in space where you plan to sleep or work, or want to hear the TV easily. The best models in our tests earn an excellent rating for cleaning the air at high and low speeds, but none of these has higher than a good rating for noise at high speed. At this point, we're painfully aware of the risk of COVID-19, which can include severe illness, long-term health effects, and even death. Wildfire smoke can also cause a number of health problems, including, but not limited to, a burning sensation in the eyes, bronchitis, asthma attacks, heart attack, and stroke. According to the EPA, this smoke, often composed of vegetation, natural fuels, and manufactured materials, has been linked to premature death and breathing troubles in children. A home air purifier can help with both of these concerns. CR's tests have found that the best models can effectively remove smoke particles and particles the size of a virus molecule, and the EPA has recommended air purifiers as an effective tool to combat viruses and smoke, noting that the airborne particles from smoke and respiratory aerosols that contain viruses are often somewhere in size range, mostly between 0.1 and 1 micron. HEPA filters are able to trap particles this size and range effectively. Power is important, too. The more air the air purifier can draw in, the better it will be able to reduce the amount of virus drops and aerosols. The same principle is true when buying an air purifier in anticipation of managing wildfire smoke. Think big, says John Galatia-Fore, CR's Associate Director of Product Testing. The particle load during these natural disasters is very high and never-ending. It just keeps coming into the room from the outside. So if you want an air purifier for one of the best CADR rates, that usually means a big filter and a big fan, the Blue Air Classic 605 and the Blue Air Pure 211 are good choices for capturing virus-sized particle or wildfire smoke. Fresh air choices. The latest air purifiers don't just remove pollutants. They may offer trim good looks and more convenience features. Smaller sizes. There are now many compact, even portable models in the market. Levoid and Purezone offer options small enough to use in a car, and LG's Puricare mini air purifier is so petite that you can carry it around your wrist. Note that CR does not test air purifiers in confined spaces like cars or planes. The smaller models we've tested typically end up with a lower overall score because they can't offer as powerful filtration as their larger counterparts do. The Leavitt Pet Care Core is $120, scored a 49. Smart features. Wi-Fi connected models that you can monitor via smartphone app, let you see a live particulate matter PM reading in your indoor air, as well as the levels of pollutants being filtered out. Some manufacturers, such as Blue Air, offer models with extra sensors that can determine the indoor air quality. The app, which doubles as a remote control, also lets you set schedules for the device and alerts you when your filter needs replacing. The Blue Air Health Protect 74701 at $640 costs a score to 77. Seeker Styling. Air purifier is a visible part of your room that's a running all the time, so you want it to both work well and look good, or at least fade into its surroundings. New designs are increasingly more streamlined and more aesthetically pleasing. The Samsung Cube, for example, is a top performer in CR's test, will soon offer custom styling options like a range of colors with a herringbone or striped front. It's already available in silver and white. The Samsung Cube costs $550 and has a 76 overall score. Not all air purifiers use HEPA filtration. When shopping the EPA and Consumer Reports, Chief Scientific Officer James Dickerson says consumers should be mindful of ozone-generating models. Breathing even low amounts of ozone can cause chest pain, shortness of breath, and throat irritations. Sears tests have also found the following technologies to be iffy at best. Electrostatic participators. These models draw air in using a fan, then giving the polluting particles an electrostatic charge that makes them adhere to collector plates, which you need to wash regularly. Inside the machine, the big con for these models is the process of charging the particles creates ozone. Ultraviolet thermocytical irradiation. As air flows in, particles are pushed toward a UVC light source, which reportedly kills the bacteria, mold, and viruses. However, the airflow tends to be very low, giving a low CADR, so many of the dirty particles in the air aren't making it to the UV light or staying exposed to it long enough for sanitizing. And photocatalytic oxidation. These models, including the much-hyped Molecule, use titanium dioxide-coated filters and UV light to trap gaseous pollutants, then break them down. The jury is still out on how effective they are. In CR's tests that focus on dust and smoke particulates, the Molecule Air earned a poor overall score, but the Molecule Air Pro was weighted good. And because we are running out of time, next week I'll run through all the different things with the different ratings, because it's pretty extensive. And because of that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for people... If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.